Hey everyone, I'm Brian Conley of Hunters HD Gold, and you're listening to Hunters HD Gold Behind the Lens. This podcast takes a deep dive into what it takes to be a match director, manufacturer, sponsored shooter, or just an everyday shooter trying to win his or her first major. So sit back and enjoy this episode of Hunters HD Gold Behind the Lens. Hey everybody, thank you so much for watching and listening to Hunters HD Gold Behind the Lens. Before this video podcast or audio podcast starts, there is a warning. This video slash podcast contains strong language and profanity. May not be suitable for children and sensitive adults. So if you're a junior shooter, make sure you get your parents' permission before listening or watching. And until then, sit back and enjoy this episode of Hunters HD Gold Behind the Lens. Welcome back to another episode of Hunters HD Gold Behind the Lens. Today, I'm sitting down with a friend of mine by the name of Jim Patrick. And, you know, I met Jim probably 4 or 5 years ago, just in a brief meeting at a knife show in Georgia, where a friend of mine named Elsie Dunwoody introduced me to him as Big Jim, where he made rings out of coins, which I thought was kind of interesting back in the day. And I reached out to Elsie not too long ago, and I said, you know, hey, what was that guy's name that, you know, made rings back then? I'd like to look at getting one of those done. He gave me the information, and I called up old Jim, and we talked for a little bit, and I told him what size ring I have, and lo and behold, I got it in the mail, and it was not the right size. So he said, well, no big deal. I'm up in North Alabama. Just send it back to me, and I'll fix it in about 10 minutes. I said, wait a minute. North Alabama? I said, wait a minute. I'll just come up there and see you. So I'm up here at Jim's house today, up here in North Alabama. We fixed my ring, and we'll talk more about that in a second. But how you doing, man?
What's up, dude?
What a long introduction, but I didn't know how to really get this one started because we just, you know, started talking a couple of days ago. But this is just kind of how I live my life sometimes. So,
well, before we start anything, could you get a brush and get those tire tracks off of me? You just put that bus on. I just like to let your audience know that the wrong size ring wasn't because of Big Jim.
No, it wasn't.
It was because of little Brian didn't send me the right freaking size.
This is true because right. I was sitting down with my wife for the night looking for a ring size. And I'll tell you, I haven't told you this yet, which you'll get a kick out of this. We thought we had something in the house to do this for sizing, and we didn't. So I took a soft, one of those like material rulers, you know, for cutting clothes,
for sewing and stuff.
Sewing ruler. And I'm putting it around my finger and looking online, trying to do all the conversions and stuff like that, and everything else. And then she had another ring that she had bought for me, you know, the one I wear on my wedding band. And it was a size 8 or something like that. So she says, there's no way I put on the other ring. There's no way you're an 8 or 9. It's 7.5. I'm like, all right, fine. So yeah, it all came from doing measurements with a sewing tape, which I don't recommend doing because you're going to be off about a full size and a half. So that's how
my grandfather would have said, that boy ain't right.
You're not the first person to ever tell me that, which makes this even better. So I love how this is getting started off. But you know, I do a podcast. You know, we talked about threw this on you last minute. Thank you for sitting down with me. But it's one of those things when I meet interesting people. A lot of times during the shooting sports, sometimes. Not. I've done a lot of people that are not. But, you know, but what all brings us together, though, and at a knife show, even that, it was all about, you know, we're all gun guys. So when did you even get into guns? Because you've got an extensive history, I have found out by being here in your office right now. But, you know, what got you started with this at such a young age? Because you made a comment. You started something when you was like 13.
I think it went way before then. Okay. I remember at 6 or 7 years old.
Wow.
Actually being able to grab a single shot shotgun and go out and hunt squirrels or rabbits.
Okay.
When I was a kid in North Carolina, my R22, old nylon 66.
Right.
It was one of those things where your parents trusted you, and every kid in school had a shotgun or a 22 and stuck up in the rear glass of the pickup.
That's right.
And we were, for a large part, we were pretty responsible.
No.
As far as standards.
We were heathens based on today's standards.
I remember being barefoot with a 12 gauge shotgun, single shot, walking through the woods.
Wow. At what age?
Between 6 and 7.
6 and 7 with a 12-gauge shotgun.
Yeah. Oh yeah,
you
oh,
were
yeah.
so
well,
that,
that's
that,
all we had. You
yeah,
know
but
mean?
that's got a kick. Oh, for
it was painful. You know that you see these YouTube videos where yeah. parents are letting their kids shoot these massive cannons yeah. and everybody's feet, you know, putting their feet. Oh, you should go to jail and this and that. Hell, when I was growing up, that was a rite of passage.
Yeah,
you know, if you can hit that milk jug on that tree with that 12-gauge, you can take it home.
Wow. So when you're out there for the first time, did you see anything or anybody?
I can't remember. But okay. I know that I realized very quickly that that little tiny dot flying across the sky wasn't as close as I thought it was.
That's wonderful.
I think I wasted a National Registry's worth of shotgun shells when I was a kid.
That's amazing. It was,
but, you know, from there... I don't know, between my grandfather and my father being an Army Ranger, military.
Both of them were Army Rangers?
No, my grandfather was.
Oh, grandfather, okay.
Both grandfathers were in World War II. One was in the Philippines.
Okay. Africa. Oh, wow.
And my father was a Ranger. He was a cook.
Oh, wow.
So I don't know if that was, he was tabbed, but he was in Bravo 2nd 75th.
Okay.
And that's where he retired out of. But I think his initial career started off as. But to get back to shooting, I just love hitting the small stuff.
Okay.
I really did. And then Fort Lewis, Washington, there was a youth program. And during that program, you could go there and you could shoot their target rifles, the old Remington.
Okay.
It was. And they taught you proper procedures and techniques, and you had to go through all the training and pass all the tests. And you shot prone and sitting and kneeling and standing. And I just, if you look up on that wall right there,
right,
I've still got those from 1973 or so.
Yes.
74, I think.
Most definitely.
And I earned, my brother and I were in at the same time, and I remember riding across Fort Lewis with a Target 22 on my back and a brick of 500 rounds to go practice, probably 2 times a week. So I got my distinguished expert as a young guy, and I got. From that point on, I just kept shooting, and I would shoot mostly for hunting, you know.
Right.
And this was, I hated injuring an animal.
And this was just a program back they had available.
Yeah, it was sponsored by the NRA.
Yeah.
It was an NRA program.
Wow. I wonder why. I hate they don't do stuff like that that I know about anyway. You know,
yeah, it's on rare occasion you see something on the news where a school's got a shooting
program. Yeah, because, I mean, bringing that kind of stuff back is what, you know, well, one, you know, we'll get into it in a second, but, you know, you shot, you know, through your career and everything else, having to do stuff as you got older anyway. So,
I did.
So, but you made a comment that you like hunting, but you didn't really like harming the animals. It was more for food and hunt.
Yeah, I didn't like them to suffer.
Right.
You know, because if I harvested an animal and it tended to suffer, I don't care how many rounds I had to put in it to make it stop. You know?
Right.
It was just one of those. I'm in it for the food. I never wasted any. If I shot a squirrel, I ate a squirrel. If I shot a rabbit, I ate a rabbit. Yeah, it was one of those things where it was just in my blood. I don't know if it's some primordial call for me, but, you know, because my heritage is up in the Irish, the Welsh, the British, the Norwegians, and the Swedes. So that's my DNA comes from.
Right. But. Well, we got, you know, I'm sure, you know, it's amazing what kind of test you can do now to find out all kinds of background history from family and everything
else.
You
can't do a common sense test, though.
No, common sense test does so much more for you. So when you're hunting at such a young age, did you ever go out with your dad or grandfather doing that stuff?
Absolutely.
Okay. So when you harvest your first animal, who were you with then?
My father. We were on Mount Rainier hunting.
Right.
It was and I can see it like it was.
Tell me about it.
So we're walking around. We had this camper that sat in the back of an old Chevy Scottsdale 20. You know, one of those ones that sat in the bed and went over the.
Yep.
So my brother and I were in there, and my dad and two of his buddies. So they had tags for the area in Mount Rainier. I had a Remington Model 788. Scope.
Nice.
I'll never forget it because it was just plain blonde wood.
Yeah.
It was just a basic rifle. My dad had a Parker Hale 308. Can't remember the scope or anything. So we're walking and walking and walking, and we would bust a deer here and bust a deer. I mean, there was really no method to the madness. They just knew, you know, they had to get high.
Right.
And they were military, so kids, you're just following them.
Yeah.
So my dad stops and his buddy stops. And I see my dad just throw this rifle up, and I see this deer as it hops. He spanks it. I mean, just, and you could actually see the deer kick out before it touched the ground.
Wow.
So it lands on the other side, and my dad, I'm running up there thinking, you know, we got one, we got one. He says, shh, be quiet. So we get up to the top of the hill. Down at the bottom of the hill, maybe 100, 150 yards, is a deer standing looking up. And my dad stops his buddy from shooting it, turns to me, and he says, go ahead and take it, but remember what I said about shooting it down. Remember, that deer's a lot closer, even though he's far away. Shoot him like he's close. And he was. I mean, he was just telling me how to dope that deer, you know, right, how to use that triangle.
And how old were you again, probably?
14.
Okay, continue.
10, 14. So, yeah, I mean, it was just A squared, B squared, plus C equals C. Those things that you didn't know the formula for it, but you knew what you were taught.
Right.
And I was standing, I popped off around, and that deer hit him right in the chest.
You did it standing up?
Standing up.
Brace, yeah, against anything at all?
Nope, just standing there with the weeds around me and the stumps from all the tree cuttings.
Wow.
So he dropped, and then he got back up and run off, and we ended up finding him. But the hard work came afterwards when they gutted him out. We put the sticks up and had to get,
yep.
I can't tell you how far it was, but it seemed like an eternity before we got back to camp.
Yeah, I tell people all the time when they go hunting for the first time or anything else, it's all fun and games till you pull the trigger. Yep.
And there was no ground shrinkage on that deer either. Mm-hmm. I mean, it wasn't the prettiest deer.
Right.
But I mean, it was mine.
How did it make you feel? Do you remember?
You know,
because you got your dad with you, you got his friend with you. There's a little bit of pride at that point, I'm sure.
Awesome pride. I mean, he was head over heels.
Yes.
And my dad grew up in that society where, you know, back then, 70s, there was a lot of misogynistic guys. That's the way they thought. The women stayed in the house and cooked. Yep. The men worked. And, you know, boys did boy things and girls did girl things.
Right.
And, it was a moment of pride for him. But, you know, also, back then, there was a lot of alcoholism and stuff like that. So it's a mixed bag when you get to go out and enjoy something. So for me, it was special. And that's why my mind opened up, like before an accident.
Yep.
When your mind opens up that piece of hard drive to store every bit of information for survival stuff. Mm-hmm. And so does the happy stuff. And I remember that. And I can remember, you know, those super happy moments. I remember the bad ones too, but the super happy.
Right.
They kind of stick with you, and that's what makes us.
That's so cool. So cool. Thanks for sharing that. You know, as you got older, when you was in school, did you do any sports when you were in school? Or what was that? What was high school like for you?
Well, I tried out for a football team when I was in North Carolina, and I made center because their center, something happened to them. Because I was a pretty good size.
I was going to say, center's a pretty good guy.
Yeah, but I was on the team for like 30 days, you
okay.
know.
And then there's a story there.
Yeah, it wasn't me, you know. It wasn't me. So,
okay.
You know, for a long time in life, early in life, I say, oh, yeah, I played football, you know. But then nobody ever asked how long or, you know, what you did. So, you know, the thing is I don't know what it makes about American society. But we always refer back the things in high school.
Yeah.
Because I think it's a pivotal time in our life where things change on a moment's notice. And
100% agree with that statement.
Until you meet somebody that you knew in high school that you thought was going to go somewhere.
Yeah. Everything. Yeah. That's not that
or
person.
That girl that you thought you wanted to marry. And then it's like,
I dodged the bullet.
Wow.
Yeah. I've seen the valedictorian at my school is like, I didn't realize that didn't go the way it was supposed to go for him in my thought process. So, you know, I won't get into that story, but you know, life happens all around us constantly. So, you know, when you were you moving around a lot with your dad in the military?
Absolutely.
Okay,
yeah,
so you're kind of what they call a military brat, I think.
Yep, every 3 to 4 years. My whole life was spent in the military except for maybe 3 years.
So, you know, there's some people I've talked to that have enjoyed that part of their life, and there's some people that were frustrated because they never really got to put their roots down to really have a
you know,
place.
I think those people get frustrated because things don't go the way they expected them.
Okay.
Their life to go. I mean, that's just my opinion.
No, that's
because
wonderful to hear.
I think being a military brat was absolutely, now that I'm an adult.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was an
absolute. Right.
I got to go to Germany. I got to go to Washington. I got to go to all these different places. But yeah, you're up and
as
moving.
As a kid.
As a kid.
Yeah.
and you're moving and you're losing friends and you think the world's going to end and you hate everything and you have to break up with the girl you're going with, or you, it's an emotional time, but I think kids adapt a lot more than we give them credit.
Okay. Okay.
Unless the parent continually tells them, oh, you're never going to adapt. Oh, that's.
Yeah.
So kids can overcome a lot of stuff.
Yes.
And I think military kids have a leg of society when it comes to.
Very good. Very good. So, you know, your grandfather was in the military.
Yep.
You were in the military.
Yep.
So is this something that, you know, you didn't feel like you had another choice but to be in the military, or did you have other choices that you were debating over before you got into it?
Well, now we're going to go back to my dad. So
I'm
not going to air dirty laundry. My dad and I knew everything. He knew everything.
Well, that's how
he
most,
was the boss.
That's not just you. That's how my son and me are today.
Oh, yeah.
So we're still cool, but it's still. It's
but my not, dad, my dad know. Had a drinking problem.
Okay.
It was a severe drinking
problem. Well, back in the 60s and 70s, it wasn't even considered a problem back then. It was considered a lifestyle.
Yep.
That's just what it was. My grandfather was like that. He owned bars in Texas.
Yeah.
And my mom, to this day, you know, has lots of bad memories from that. I'm like going, I knew my grandfather's this cool guy.
Yeah,
and,
exactly.
But it's different.
They knew how to hide it.
It's a different time. And that's you know, so airing dirty laundry, but it's a different time. But that, you know, so yeah, I could see there could be some, you know,
well, let me tell you, I don't hold a grudge because I know alcoholism is a problem.
Right.
But my dad was also physically abusive.
Okay.
And that's how I ended up joining the military.
Okay.
And I'm going to tell you, this is how it happened. So my dad, he goes to work. We didn't have to go to school. So my brother and I, his 2 years younger, look, you need to dig this trench to the hogs so that we can bury this water line. About 35, 40 yards. So my brother and I think, you know, two of us, we could dig that, you know, in the last 10 minutes before he gets home.
What time of year was this?
It was summertime.
Okay, good. I was making sure.
So, but when he said 18 inches, it had to be 18 inches.
Yes.
Otherwise, it gave him a reason.
Okay.
Getting your shit.
Okay.
So me and my brother, you know, it's like that little cartoon you see in Sunday paper. The little kids, they tell them, hey, go check the mail. And there's this dotted line all over the countryside. And then 16 hours later, they come back and go, what'd you want me to do?
Yes, sir.
So that was us, you know.
That's amazing.
So we did whatever we did that day. And my brother went somewhere. Dad came home early. All hell broke loose.
Wow.
We dug about half of it and drunk. So
it was. It was
I took the ass end of that. And I ended up leaving the house because I just couldn't stay anymore.
Right.
And I was working at the time. I've always worked.
Okay. Well, kind of, what were you doing?
I was working at a travel center selling cigarettes for $2.30 something cents a carton.
Wow.
But I was making good money. So here's how this works. I'm already learning.
Okay.
I'm already learning how to put dollars in my pocket.
Okay.
So here I am, this young guy. I'm working at Daryl's Travel Center.
Yeah.
And the people were just lovely. Loved me to death, and I love them. So the truckers coming from the north going down south on their loads on I-95 were right off I-95 in North Carolina.
Okay.
They would stop by and give me a list. And it would be, I want 100 cartons of this, 200 cartons of that, 400 cartons of this, 300 cartons of that. And they would pay. So I would either put their order together or drive down to Rocky Mount, which was 30 miles away, to the big warehouse, get the cigarettes, bring them back. And I would have them all in an area for them when they came back. To the north, because I didn't know this, but they were taking them back up north and selling the damn things for $10, $12, $13 a carton. And here they are giving me a quarter of a freaking carton.
You were a middleman.
You know, yeah. And I didn't know it. I was perpetrating a crime, you know, and didn't know it. Well, I mean, I caught on later, but it was just, I was like, man, these guys are buying a lot of cigarettes. But, you know, at 30 cents a pack, I mean, they were making good money.
Right.
So when this happened with my dad and I, they said, look, we've got this extra room at the business. You stay here and you work and we'll pay you still the salary.
Oh, you were a family then. That's one.
Yeah. So I did. And I stayed there for a while. And I came home. My mom says, hey, come home. Everything's good. He's not mad. So I came home. And that first dinner, was just silence, the heavy breathing through the nose, you know. And then he said something. And he goes, I didn't ask you to come back here. And I'm looking across the table. We lived in a double white trailer. And I said, well, what do you want me to do? Well, you think you're a man? Go do man stuff. I said, okay, I'll join the military. And at that point.
What did his demeanor change?
Here.
Oh. Okay.
Well, actually, there's one more focus. I'll tell you in just a second.
My demeanor changed, so continue.
So he said, but I was too young to sign up for my own. I was a year out from graduation.
Okay.
And they had to sign for me. I was 16 or 17.
Okay. So
the recruiter comes by. He's shooting me all these lines, and my dad's acting like this big, you know, war military guy. Yeah, well, you know, he shouldn't be doing this. And I mean, sticking up for me. I'm going, geez, where was all this, you know, the past 10 years?
Right.
So I signed up to be a military policeman and to be assigned at Fort Eustis, Virginia, which is 125.
Okay.
And I remember the day they dropped me off at the Greyhound bus station. Get on the bus. I ride the bus.
Right.
And go through MP school and get stationed at Fort Eustis, Virginia. And this is where my life really changed. I became after 3 years there, working gates and mids. And
so you went in as military police.
Yeah.
So you went through basic training, learned how to dig 18-inch holes a lot quicker, I'm sure.
Well, where was that when I needed it? Huh?
Exactly. And they put you, how many years of basic training did you do? How long was that?
I think it's 6 to 8 weeks of basic training. That's what I'm thinking. 14 weeks of AIT, advanced individual training.
So you're just now getting 17 or 18.
No, I was 18. I had to graduate high school. It's called a delayed entry program. So I could sign up.
We're on the same page now.
And the benefit for that was it counted as an extra year of longevity in the military. So when I went in and got out of basic, if I graduated basic AIT, instead of having 1 year for pay, I would actually have 2 years because I had that delayed. And that stays throughout the rest of your career.
Oh, wow.
So when I retired at 28 years, you know, I actually had 27, you know, active duty. So I went to Anderson and learned how to drive a Jeep.
And they put you on military police.
Yeah. Well, that's what I selected.
So, yeah.
Yeah. One of those things where I thought I wanted to be a cop afterwards.
Okay. So did you, were you, how long did you do that?
Almost 4 years. Right at 4 years, because I was an E4 when I went to flight school. I ended up, they needed a military police game warden on the installation because what happened was you had two federal game wardens, but then they didn't have a military liaison to actually apprehend, do paperwork, and know the for people that broke the law.
Right.
So I applied for it and I got it. And I got to essentially make my own hours. And, you know, back then, E3 and E4 pay was like $300 or $400 a month.
So right.
I had to have an extra job at night. Apartment complex. And the turning point for me was being the kid that my grandparents and my parents wanted. Being respectful. And that was because that one guy lost his deer during hunting.
Okay.
And he was in one of the areas where you had to have name drawn. You had to hunt from a stand. You couldn't go look for the deer if you wounded it. Mm-hmm. And he came in that evening and he talked to me. He said, look, yeah, dark now. I mean, see what we can do. So he left and I felt guilty actually.
Based on your history of hunting.
Yeah. And it wasn't so much that I didn't go because I didn't want to. It was because that was what the rules were.
Right.
But anyway, I ended up breaking the rules and going out to the range that night. I had a Jeep CJ5 or CJ7.
But you were an officer, though.
No. I was enlisted.
You're enlisted as a
military police game warden.
But you had, so the game warden part of you allowed you to go do that anyway, really? Or is that just a gray area?
Yeah, but my two bosses were federal game wardens.
Oh,
so
okay.
I was a military guy working for them.
Got it.
The rules on the post were nobody in the area, restricted areas.
Okay.
And, you know, just, so I went out there anyway.
Yeah,
it was on the peninsula. So on what's called a dead fleet. It's Fort Eustis, Virginia. Mm-hmm. And I ended up finding his deer. I threw it in the back of the CJ, drove back, went to the cooler. We had a big walk-in cooler. Mm-hmm. Skinned it up. Well, I gutted it out in the field. Skinned it out, put his tag. Next day when he comes up, I forgot it was in there actually because I was doing other shit. And I see him coming up and I'm like, oh, Should have told him. So he says, hey, go out and get it. And he's in uniform. He's a W-4.
What is a W-4?
A Chief Warrant Officer 4.
Okay.
They're the technicians of the Army. They're
okay.
They're not the commissioned officers, the colonels, the captains. They're officers, but they're the technicians. They're the specialty
officers. Okay. I'm not familiar with all that.
They don't have the UCMJ. Well, they didn't back then. They didn't have the authority. Commission guys, they were just like, we like you a lot.
Yeah.
And we're going to make you an officer, but you can't, you know, do this.
So okay, got it.
That was the warrant officer. And then over the years, you know, you just become the subject matter expert and the lazy guy that doesn't show up for PT. And, you know, they just look at reasons to pick at you. But I told him, come on in the locker. He says, what's going on? So we go in and I said, told me right there. He says, you know what? He said, I've dealt with you in the past. You don't need to be enlisted. There are better things for you out there. He said, you can tell you come from a military background. And I was flattered, actactually. But, you know, as a young guy in the early 20s,
you don't recognize it.
Mm-mm. You just don't. You go think the guys, and he wanted to tip me too. They said, look, I'm going to come back. We're going to do lunch tomorrow or the next day. I want you to apply for flight school.
Yeah. That was kind of random.
Well, it's the quickest way as a young enlisted guy to get to the warrant officer ranks.
Oh, okay.
If you could pass all the tests.
Okay.
So he asked me what my initial entry tests were and this, that, and they were all below par. So I had to retake all those. Barred for flight school.
Mm-hmm.
I took him, I put the application in, he looked at it, he wrote me a letter of recommendation, which I have somewhere here in this massive pile of I love me shit.
I love this office.
Got accepted like 6 months later.
Holy cow.
This was in 1981, late 1981, I got accepted.
Wow. Take a quick break.
Yep,
let's talk to one of our sponsors. And we'll get back in and talk about what happened after that.
This week's podcast is brought to you by Kona Gold. Kona Gold is a premier lifestyle brand for those who work hard and play harder. There are many hemp companies out there that get lost in the crowd, but Kona Gold sets the gold standard with its premier line of products. When traveling all around with a Magical Mystery Tour to different matches, I travel around with lots of different flavors, including pink grapefruit, candy apple, and vanilla cherry. Make sure to stop by and get some for yourself. They are all zero calories, zero sugar, use organic hemp, and are THC and CBD free. Competitive shooters love them because there's no shakes, no headaches, and no crash. When you order from KonaGoldHemp.com, make sure to use discount code HuntersHD for another 20% off.
So lo and behold, you're going into flight school.
Yep.
What did that phone call look like when you called back home to give them that noise?
Honestly, I can't remember how I was notified. They have a board that meets, and after the board meets, the results come out through official channels. And but I was a young E4 at the time, and it was kind of weird. My former spouse, she was in college at the time. Her parents, her father. Now this is kind of weird. Her father was a former warrant officer pilot in Vietnam.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so I don't want to lose my lunch.
I get it.
So, yeah, I'm already getting hives thinking about it.
Oh, my goodness.
No. But, I went to flight school. It wasn't without its trouble because you're just thrust into this environment where you're running and you're under total control of everyone. You're rolling your underwear 6 inches and you're ironing the shit out of the ends of it with starch so that it's exactly sinks. Because if it's 6 1/8, you know, you get dinged for it. You get so many dings a week, demerits.
Right.
And if you get these many demerits, then, you know, you get kicked out.
Wow. You
know, flight school was tough, dude.
The stress level was different altogether.
Oh, 8 weeks of just pure hell. Getting up at 5, outside standing in formation with your bed made by 5:07. Running PT for an hour, hour and a half, coming back, taking a shower, cleaning up, going to academics all day, running everywhere you went. Everywhere you went, you ran.
What'd they think about you coming in with your experience or non-experience?
It didn't matter. You're okay. Once you get into that melting pot,
okay,
there are guys greater than you and guys lesser than you and girls lesser than you, girls greater than you.
But it doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter because everybody's fighting. Well, what they do teach you, though, is attention to detail.
Okay.
And I'm sure you see that now.
We will definitely talk about that in a little bit.
I'm sure you see attention to detail.
I saw a lot today.
So, but actually, it's a curse. It's the curse of the pilot.
Okay.
You're inundated until 11 o'clock at night with just go, 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 go. Your body is just an automaton of breathing and mm-hmm. And you're hoping you don't fail out, because then you realize you reach a point where you've put in so much effort that you just can't fail. And then you realize that, hey, I'm going to be somebody. I can't go back to my own.
Right.
You know,
was this time behind just learning mechanical stuff? Were you like,
no, this is all discipline.
Okay.
Attention.
So for 8 weeks, this is like, boot camp all over again.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. You didn't learn jack shit about flying.
Fair enough. So you got through the 8 weeks. And what's next? They just
11 months of hell.
11 months of hell.
So you start back then, it was 60.
I thought boot camp was bad. Yeah, no, there's different levels of hell, I see. Yeah,
when I went through, it was 60th company, which was the 8 weeks, and then 61st, which was an intermediate, and then the final second company. That's once you got into the tactics and the low-level flying and the night flying, and then you eventually, the last 6 or 8 weeks, got a transition to whatever aircraft they were going to be. So when you went over to 62nd Company, you were either going over as a Huey guy, a Cobra guy, or a 58 guy, or a Chinook guy. Mm-hmm. And today it's, Blackhawks, 64s, Apaches,
right. But it's not like drawing straws. How do they choose where you're going?
Class standing had a lot to do with it, too. And I was never, ever picked as one of the class leaders.
So. Right.
But you had these guys. And here's the dichotomy of that. You realize when you're standing there, I was a young Spec 4 MP. There were guys there that were coming from high school to flight school that mm-hmm. had previous civilian flight time. Also guys, 6 E7s. Special forces that had decided to go to flight school mm-hmm. out of their original MOS. So it was just a melting pot of knowledge and testosterone and experience and time and service. Quite frankly, it's pretty ingenious that Army Aviation has that.
Right.
So yeah, you go through school and you end up graduating, and that's when the real work starts. Because you think you're hot shit, when you leave.
Six to eight, man. I'm always going back in my mind because I grew up in the 70s, 80s. I'm thinking about Top Gun.
Not even close,
I don't think it's like that, is it?
Yeah. Top Buns. Yeah. So the thing with a warrant officer, though, is before you get your wings, I don't know what regulation that covered it, quite frankly. I can't remember what it is. I used to know.
Yeah.
But before you got your wings, you had to be an officer for 24 hours.
24 hours.
So what they would do is you would graduate flight school and they would pin you with your W-1 bar.
Okay.
And then the next day they would have the wing ceremony. It was just, I don't know what regulation. I guess 24 hours, was the magic number or something. But that.
It looked good on.
But you know what's funny, though, is there were always people that screwed the boots.
In 24 hours?
In 24 hours.
They screwed up.
I'm telling you. Either that or the day before, pinning on the bar.
And you,
because your family could come down.
Yeah.
And see, now, until the last 12 weeks of that whole year, you could not have your family. You could have your family there, but you couldn't live off post. It wasn't until you reached the last stage that you could actually go and live off post with your family if they were there, instead of living in the barracks. Mm-hmm. So you're always captive. And you're always under this ever watchful eye. And then on this installation, everybody knew you were WOC because you had these three letters on both collars that said WOC, and you had it on your hat. And you had a disc the color of your flight. And mm-hmm. I mean, you were just with this walking little rainbow of, hey, fuck with him.
Yeah, because that's people screwed up in the last.
Oh yeah,
hour.
Buddy. Oh, it's.
That's just amazing.
And what you think about the tragedy of that?
Yeah, that's because relationships are built and gone that quick.
And there's no going back. I don't know anybody that ever really screwed up. I can probably think of, I can see the faces of probably three or four people that did it when I was in flight school.
Right.
But see, years later, and we may get into this in a little bit, but years later, probably, let's see, 8 years after I graduated flight school, I ended up coming back to Fort Rucker as a TAC officer, a training advising counselor. Mm-hmm. So I was the guy that was beating these guys in the ground. Oh, I was a monster too, man. I was a monster. I was in such good physical shape. If I was to walk in here as what I was now, I'd call myself a fatty.
Right.
You know, I mean, and dare me to fucking do anything about it. You know, that's
exactly.
Oh, dude. I mean, you've seen some of that. I mean, yeah. I was Afghanistan. I was 47 right there.
Right.
I mean, I was benching 350 pounds.
Wow.
I was a beast. And then, you know, a couple spine surgeries and shit like that afterwards. Right. And then you sandwiches and Oreos. Oreo will kick your ass.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's amazing. You know, you get your wings.
Yeah.
And then, you know, not much conflict is happening at the time, I take it? Or was it calm for a little bit?
Well, the only thing that was going on at that time was Central America, you mm-hmm. know, Ollie North and all that shit that was going on.
Yeah.
So here's what happens. You get your aircraft. So I was Huey guy.
Okay.
UH-1s. And the assignments come down. You know, there's an assignment day and everybody goes to the board and looks.
You're saying that like you're excited.
Well, I thought I was going to be excited when I saw it.
Continue. You know,
well, everybody is excited because they want to beat feet in there and hopefully mm-hmm. they get what they asked for.
Right.
Well, I looked up there and there was this thing called Fort Riley, Kansas. And I'm like, where the is Fort Riley? So I look it up on a map because we didn't have cell phones and shit like that. So it was in Kansas, and I told my ex, whatever.
Yeah.
I said, we're going to Fort Riley, Kansas. And all hell broke loose because her family's on the East Coast. So is mine. But I'm like, you know, I got the wandering gene in me, you know?
Yeah.
So we go there, and that was, I will tell you, as far as aviation goes, that was the best thing the Army. Because they had a lot of old school Vietnam vets.
Okay.
They had a lot of old school Huey and Cobra pilot guys that took those 13 new warrant officers that showed up when we just molded us into.
Well, there's also not any mountains in Kansas.
Yeah, there's some hills.
Because I'm thinking to myself, if I get in a helicopter, I don't want a lot of obstacles in front of me. Yeah. But I
helicopters,
guess.
You know, if you're in the mountains, you'd rather be in a helicopter than you would a fixed wing.
Yeah.
You could put a helicopter in.
Yeah, I've been in a helicopter once, and it was, I went on vacationing with my son, and we went around an island in Hawaii, or Kauai, actually. And the only time I've ever been in a helicopter, and it was a weird feeling floating for the first time when you just go off the ground. It's like going, this is not like a wing at all.
Yeah, it's like a bumblebee.
It's different. It's totally different. So you're in Kansas.
Yep.
You're learning a lot of history and a lot of current stuff based on what your flight, your helicopter is and everything else. So you learn a lot of stuff that you don't see in the books, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah.
That's where a lot of
you might as well forget everything that was behind you
right.
when you get there. You know, they tell you when you get there, you don't know shit. Shut your mouth and use those two ears for listening.
Right. Wow. And, you know, and then things started happening in life, and you did do a lot of tours. You went all over with a helicopter, right?
Well, while we were at Fort Riley, we actually deployed to Central America. We ended up in what was called, it's now called Soto Cano, called Pomerola at the time. Mm-hmm. And then we had a unit that would swap out every few weeks, 2 to 6 weeks, Salvador. And that was when all the Ollie North shit was going on, you mm-hmm. know, and El Salvador was having their civil war. And it really wasn't, if my memory serves me correctly, it was not even designated combat zone until, I believe, 1991, when they shot down one of our Hueys and killed a lieutenant colonel. Mm-hmm. I think it was 1991. But and then finally they go, oh shit, you know, this is mm-hmm. So if you go to the memorials, most of the memorials where they list, you know, the Civil War, Revolutionary War, French Indian War, any of these wars that we've taken place, losses that were in there, they now list Salvador too.
Do they really?
Oh yeah. Yeah. So that was my first combat patch. And if you'll look, it's on this wall or not, but
right.
in that was my first combat patch that I proudly wore, the big red one.
Okay.
The 1st Infantry Division. And I wore that even my first tour in Afghanistan, where they want you to wear, you know, the 10th Mountain patch, because I went with 10th Mountain in 2003. And they say, you know, you should wear that. I'm going, oh, that's my first one I'm wearing.
Oh, wow.
So.
And yeah, they don't argue back.
No, either. I mean, I was a W-5 at the time. So okay. I was one of those unicorns where, you know, they told you what to do, but yeah. they didn't follow up on it because they knew you weren't going to do it anyway. Nice. You know, but yes. they're going to need you later.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know,
we're going to keep him as a friend.
Yeah. It was a nice thing to have, you know, I'm telling you, it was, but we'll get into that in a second.
Yeah. Because, you know, did you ever, and I can't imagine, and if you don't want to talk about this, I totally understand it, but the first time, this is what just makes me just awed at all with anybody who's done military and had to do some kind of service where it's not comfortable. The first time a gun's going off and it's not you pulling the trigger, but it's somebody pulling the trigger towards your direction in a helicopter. Because I can't imagine, you know, you know, I watch TV. I watch, you know, stuff that's all glorified and how they want to do it. It's all crap, some of it anyway. But the reason I'm asking that question is I've told you I've been in a helicopter one time. It's a small compartment. It's not a big area. Right. And it don't feel like there's, you know, not a lot of things you can do to be protected in a helicopter. Maybe I'm wrong.
Well, big sky, little bullet theory.
Okay.
You know?
Okay.
Seriously, I mean, there are probably times in my career where I was shot at and then I didn't know I was being shot at.
Okay.
You know, from El Salvador to Afghanistan to Mosul when we went there for the 6-6 Cav. We had some issues with 6-6 Cav, but we were the brigade for them. So I really don't know how to answer that.
Yeah, that's
you know,
fine.
When you get over there, it's moments of sheer panic. Surrounded by a lifetime of boredom.
Okay.
You know, I mean, it's just because, like, if I'm going to go out on a 4-hour mission, I'm going to spend a couple of hours the day before planning.
Okay.
I'm going to spend some time that morning updating the weather and the NOTAMs and all the off limits areas and the troops in contact in that area and things like that.
Okay.
I'm going to get all the information that's available to me through the Battle Operations
Center. Right.
And then we're going to do rebrief and we're going to brief the crew chiefs and everybody's going to go out and you actually prepare yourself.
So it just sounds like your mind is so busy with other things. You don't have, it's not there.
No, I think what it is you get a level of comfort.
Okay.
Knowing that you've done absolutely freaking everything that you can do.
Okay.
If you're still the professional that you profess to be, that if something happens, you hope that you have the wherewithal to overcome it or to get your ass out of it or get the guys that you're going to see or get out.
Because that was your main thing was getting people out, putting people in situations, getting them out?
No, actually, you know, I mean, flying a Black Hawk, you're a lift guy.
Okay.
You're a bus driver. You supply troops. You get a mission, you know, you need to fly these 8 guys to Skin, Afghanistan. You need to drop them off. You need to bring back these 4 ammo crates, you know. So you're the lift driver.
Okay, I get it.
So you're doing the mission. But, I mean, that doesn't negate all the pre-planning and the pre-briefs and the post-briefs. I mean, it doesn't negate any of that. Every mission should be planned out just as one that you know that you're going into that you're going to get troops in contact.
Do you have a co-pilot with you?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay. Yeah.
Black Hawk is a two pilot aircraft.
Okay.
Usually had
always the same co-pilot or somebody always.
No, it was different, and you didn't always have the same aircraft either.
Oh, really?
So what you would do is you would go in because I mean the maintenance schedule changes that, you know. And
I remember I heard somebody tell me one time, and I can't remember his name right now, but he's down in Florida. He said, you know, 155 something moving parts made by the lowest bidder.
Oh, yeah. I don't know. The Blackhawk's a great aircraft.
No, I'm talking about just, he was talking about in general, yeah. some stuff. He didn't specify any certain aircraft.
I'm going to tell you something. And there's a lot of waste. You know, when you see the waste and you start to season, you know, get a little older in the military, and you start to see the just absolute inability to maintain some type of normal flow or operations, or you see the inadequacy of other folks, but they're in a leadership position, driving the people that can actually do the mission. We're a microcosm of society.
Right.
You know, we have good, bad, ugly, fat, skinny. I mean, it's just that we have that brotherhood, mm-hmm. you know, and to the unindoctrinated, I sum it up as by saying, if you want to know what the military is you being on the ground stuck somewhere and the shit is hitting the fan. And you see a couple of 18-year-olds that you have no idea who they are. You don't know their name. You don't know their sexual preference. You don't know shit about them. But they're running across a fucking field of bullets and a hail of gunfire, being supported by the guys in the back to pick up somebody that's down that they don't know. And that's, wow. to me, that's the military.
Okay.
You know, like when they, when you, when the medevac guys, I mean, God bless those guys. I never pulled a medevac mission. But those guys, man, that's why I was telling you, watch Hornet's Nest.
Hornet's Nest.
Yeah, watch the Hornet's Nest. It's, I think it's a good documentary. It wow. truly is. But when those guys go in there, I mean, shit's flying. They're going in to pick up that wounded guy. Mm-hmm. Because he's one of us.
Wow.
Yeah. It's, and you never get rid of that. You know, the older you get, you start shrinking up. But, you know, if you're military and you had pride in your service and you did something, have a long shadow. There's a long shadow behind it. No matter how broken we get, no matter how tired we get. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's evidence by, and you surround yourself. Look in here. I mean, you surround yes. yourself to continually remind you of who you were and what you did. People that you lost.
Yeah. And that's, you know, there's so much in this room of all the medals and pictures and, you know, crews, just so much here to put you in a place of, you know, when you come in your office and you're having a bad day and out in the shop, which we'll talk about in a second, you come in here, does this put you back at a place of just reflection to come?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
It's comfort.
Good.
It's comfort. And that's why you see all the shit that, people have given me over the years mm-hmm. that I don't get rid of until they die mm-hmm. or I die and somebody else gets rid of it for me. You know, I mean, seriously.
Oh, no.
Like, I mean,
I know what you're talking
about. Yeah. This innocuous shit that I have in here. Mm-hmm. Like, look, see this little thing right here?
Yeah.
Okay. So one of my best friends gave that to me, the guy that used to own Almar Knives, Gary yeah. Fadden.
Okay. Okay. And for people that are just listening, that's just a, what is that?
Exactly.
I don't know what it is.
Exactly.
It looks like a stainless steel cylinder with a
vibrator for a Martian.
Well, you know? Okay, so, we can call it
but
that.
Anyway, look, so it's about 4.5 inches long. It's, yeah. it's hand carved out of stainless steel, but yeah. the precision of it is so exact that yeah. when you pull this center proboscis out, there's a pin.
It's a pin.
But watch what happens when you drop it in.
People that are listening to this podcast, it's going in very slowly, like its own hydraulics.
Yeah,
that's crazy.
Okay, and then if you pull it up, it'll bounce because the tolerance. So to me, it was given to me as a gift, and okay. this little knob right here,
yeah.
you can adjust the pressure that goes in and out. So if you want it to fall faster, you turn that knob. So right. some little engineer somewhere,
right.
like us, that's OCD as hell, sat around and said, you know, I'm going to make a little pin that bounces and 5 or 6 or 10 years from now, it's going to be driving some old W5 fucking bonkers. So,
that's amazing.
So I keep that
yeah.
to remind me. If I ever see the engineer that did this, I'm going to shove it up his ass.
And what did that engineer do? How did you meet him? You remember?
Gary couldn't even answer the question. The guy okay. that gave it to me. So okay. what he did was he pawned off his OCD bullshit to me. So speaking of OCD, like this. So one day he sends this to me.
You're right.
And I'm looking for the meaning in it. And what it is it's a bronze wild boar.
Yeah.
So I waste my time calling him and go, hey man, what is this secret little thing he sent me? Oh, I don't know, some fucking wild boar I found in a box. I'm like, you're a dick. You know,
I love that.
No, yeah, you think that shit's funny, but
you
to
haven't
me,
got rid of
but
it.
But I don't get rid of it. You know, guy sends me a helmet. Somebody sends me yeah. this and something. Like that. But you know what? I look at it and I think they cared enough to
something. So, yeah. So,
and that's where that bond comes from in life.
It is. It's the bond. It's the attention to detail. It's everything yeah. wrapped in one. Well, let's take one more quick break.
All right.
Let's talk about, you know, what you're doing today to engineer yourself, to make things that I believe are gifts that last a lifetime.
What, loaning sandwiches?
That too. We'll talk about it in a second.
This week's podcast is also sponsored by Make Ready Nutrition. They have three products available for shooters that are 2-Alpha Performance to drink before hammer down, 2-Alpha Recovery that I use personally as a meal replacement for lunch with 34 grams of protein and is low carb, 2-Alpha Ammunition, which is next level hydration plus energy and amino acids for shooters, gym workouts, or pushing your body in sports and recreation. Whether you're in the Texas heat or in Arizona desert, 2-Alpha Ammunition works harder and endures longer. This unique formula is manufactured for shooters by shooters to replenish your body with electrolytes and hydration while helping aid in muscle recovery and providing fast energy. For 25% off your next order, go to makereadynutrition.com/discount/huntershd or enter huntershd at checkout for 25% off your entire order. makereadynutrition.com. Are you ready?
You know, it's something I want to talk about real quick before we get back into this, because you told me a story earlier in the shop, because, you know, I do a lot around the shooting sports and everything. And you actually had an opportunity to participate in the shooting sports a little bit.
Oh, I did.
As a pilot, which was interesting to me as well. So,
you know, the bad thing about it, though, is when you say you told me a story. You know, I'm okay. From the South. When you tell somebody a story, you're lying to them. So I would like this, you know. Just caveat that by saying that I relayed some of my life's business to him.
So it was amazing. But no, because share that about the, you know, because you've dabbled a little bit in the shooting sports.
I have. Like I said, I mean, I grew up shooting, dad, grandfather. But I was at, I got stationed in Alaska. To me,
Alaska.
Oh my God!
Was this like a mission? Like came down the pike and
no, I got orders to go to Alaska, and I was the initial tour.
What'd you do wrong?
3 years, nothing. Well, you know, initially I didn't know much about it.
Okay,
but and again, I was coming from Fort Riley, Kansas.
Yeah,
where they honed my aviation skills. I mean, they beat you into a good pilot.
Okay,
when you left Fort Riley, Kansas. Mm-hmm. After the missions in El Salvador and Honduras and mountain flying and water flying and shipboard ops, when you left there as a pilot in command and went somewhere else, you flowed right into their system. You were integrated into their program so easily because you were.
Wow.
It was truly, yeah, those guys there. And, you know, at the time you think, God, how many times are they going to beat this stupid dog? You
right.
know, but you always thought you were the downtrodden, you know, redheaded stepchild. But, but you know, looking back, it was. So I go to Alaska, and here's something too. I'm going to tell you something about that. So we go to Alaska, and I get integrated into the flight program. And usually, if you go to a unit, there's a process that you have to go through to be a pilot in command. You know, you go through. Training, readiness level training, RL 1, 2, and 3. Mm-hmm. You do the mission. You end up doing ski operations. You do glacier operations, mountain operations, high wind operations, blowing snow ops. You know, all the stuff for the environment you're flying.
Oh, my goodness.
So, I mean, there are last stop measure for the mission.
Right.
So I'm up there training, and just on the side, I'm going to divert here a second. A mile away from here is a friend of mine, Gary Graham, who okay. won the knife competition, Forge and Fire.
Okay.
He's a Forge and Fire champion.
Okay.
He's a mile away from here, Gary.
Okay.
And Gary came to the unit as a new W-1, and I was a pilot in command, but I was also the night vision goggle trainer. So Gary and I go out after he makes a certain readiness, go out and I'm training him. And this is, you figure this is the mid 80s. So the goggles are mm-hmm. cutaways. We go out one night, we've got the weather to go, but there were scattered snow showers, but they were in pockets moving around like these marshmallows in the sky. Mm-hmm. So we, long story short, we ended up punching into the clouds, pink light on, and both of our goggles shut down because flight, end up losing control of the aircraft. I was disoriented because when he was turning in a right-hand turn, we were going to leave because the weather had deteriorated. I told him to orbit in right-hand turns while I contacted Anchorage. We were going to get in what's called a precision, where they tell you turn right, turn left, turn left.
And, you were totally blind.
Well, we weren't at the time.
Right.
But we were going to ask for that because that was the only way you could get across the inlet at lower altitudes.
Right.
Is if you were on radar. That was one of our rules.
Right.
So the ceilings had dropped. There's a rule. There's a saying in Alaska. If you don't like the weather, wait 5 minutes and it'll change. And it's true. So we were in this right-hand turn and I'm looking down at the radios. I'm tuning and I'm talking to approach control. And they give me a heading to turn to. I had turned his mic down so that he didn't have to listen. And they said, turn left to a heading. And I flipped the switch up and I said, Gary, turn left to heading such and such. And as I turned my head to look out the window to clear the aircraft to say clear left, I would punch it into a cloud. And that's when everything happened. So I said, I have the controls because I'm the pilot in command. But what I didn't realize at the time was I had severe spatial disorientation. You know, because when your head's tilted and you're turning in a turn, that fluid in the three canals in your ear starts flowing. It gets an equilibrium. It's like taking a glass of vodka or bourbon and swirling it around, and then you let go and it continues to move.
Correct.
Well, that's what your ear's doing. So I actually thought I was leveling the aircraft. I wasn't. I was getting it in worse condition. Gary says, hey, you're doing this, you're doing that. I said, you have the controls. I give him the controls. He levels the aircraft. My attitude indicator had actually failed, which is, it's one in a billion chances.
Wow.
We're over what's called Goose Bay, Alaska. The crew chief in the back is yelling, hey, somebody get this motherfucker under control so we can't talk to each other. Mm-hmm. His name was Vic Carpenter. He's just absolutely blowing it out of the water. So I tell him to shut up. So then Gary levels the aircraft, but I notice I always had my pinky on the door, my hand on the collective and my pinky on the door. And I knew if I was pulling power, 51 PSI is about UE on a really good day. Mm-hmm. And it's all calibrated to the aircraft, the engine power, and I mean, a whole bunch of other extra. I felt my pinky leaving the door, which meant Gary was pulling on the collective, which could have either oversped the aircraft or decreased the rotor, over-torqued it, or, you know, it depends. And we were already 60 knots. So I said, Gary, I have the controls. So I said, you sure? And I said, yeah. I ended up looking at his attitude indicator, lowering out of the clouds at five over Goose Bay Prison in Alaska. So we had put the aircraft through. I wish that it had had some type of recording just to see what had happened. We actually, most people that get in like this crash that they had up on 53. Mm-hmm. You know, once you get spatial disorientation and lose control of your, we were quite fortunate. So Gary and I have been lifelong friends. We tell that story a lot. We survived. We caught fish. We killed bears like that one up there. I killed in Copper River, which I need to dust.
Who taught you the pinky thing?
It was just one of those things when I went, one of my IPs maybe taught. You know,
I'm just the little detail of that.
So what you do is, you know, if you're flying left seat or if you're flying left seat,
right,
just put your pinky on the door. Or if you're flying right seat, put your pinky and just hand over to collective. And that way you know. So what you do is you'd pull power in as you just, and you knew where it was going to leave.
It just amazed me that.
And years later, years later, I ended up being an instructor pilot at Fort Rucker. I mean, I was teaching, I was pushing.
Talking about that kind of stuff as well.
Yeah, all the time. Yeah, wow. Passing on the lessons learned, not keeping them like you were some guy sitting on a dog fart, you know.
So, I love you. That's amazing.
Now getting back full circle here. When I was there, I had a commander. We played racquetball. We fished. We hunted. It was a great tour.
Yeah.
But there was a CG match coming up for the commanding general's matches. And it was a leg match, actually. So you could actually earn leg points.
Okay.
And you know what leg points
are. I'm trying to make it out, but I don't.
If you shoot a match, a camp parry or something, and you place in the top 10%, you know, you're the president's 100. But if you if you place past a certain cut, you get leg points for shooting that match.
Okay.
And then there's a bronze. Matter of fact, see that medal up there
yep.
at the top right?
Yep. Two guns. Yep.
Yeah, that's a leg match.
Okay.
So that's a bronze. So what you do is they were gonna have a CG's match, and if a CG's gonna have a match and the Army pistol team's gonna put it on, you better have teams participate. So when the general says, hey, every major unit on this post better have a freaking team. So his name is John Bithos, and he was such a dick. He was the commander at the time as a major, and I hated him. You know, he was one of these real skinny guys that ran all the time that right. thought everybody else should run. So if you had an ounce of fat on you that was in the wrong place, you know, you were the mortal enemy. You were Gustav Gloop or whatever on fucking Willy Wonka. You'd fallen into chocolate vat.
That's amazing.
So... Yeah, so he comes up to me knowing I shoot all the time. You know, yeah. I go to the range and shoot.
Yeah.
And he says, hey, Mr. Patrick, I need you to get us a team of six guys together. Okay. Goes, well, okay, sir, what is it? He goes, you got two fucking weeks. I was like, holy shit. But I know all the guys that shoot. So I get the team together. We go out. We shoot the day course. We shoot the combat course. We shoot the night course. And you know what we did? You didn't have tritium or any of that shit back then in the mid-80s. So
right.
we broke open chem lights and spattered them on the front of our 45s that we had to freaking borrow from the infantry because the aviation's so gay that we have 38s. You know, I mean, come on now. When I was in El Salvador, we had a 38, a Smith & Wesson Model 10.
Right.
And they go, what are you going to do with this? And they go, it's not for the enemy. It's to kill yourself if you get shot down. You know? A six-shot 38 with ball ammo, military ball ammo. And it wasn't even freaking brass-coated. It was lead ammo.
That's a lead poisoning. So you didn't
die yet. So I got the team together. We shot the match, and we freaking won.
You won.
We beat the infantry. We beat everyone.
I don't think that would have went over well, being a bunch of pilots coming in.
And we were all new shooters. So we got... all of us got leg points. So
right.
We got 3 points. I think it was 3 points. And we got trophies.
Yeah.
We got our pictures in the paper and everything like that. And, oh, it's kind of amazing. But here's where it changed. So the civilian, I mean, I maxed the shit. I shot.
Right.
Like a man possessed. I was a young W-2, and the civilian that was running the match for the Army says, hey, would you be interested in trying out for the... Ooh, does that mean I get to go to Camp Perry and shoot against the Marines and the FBI and all these guys that kick everybody's ass all the time? He goes, yeah. So a couple months went by. Paperwork came through. This was at the 6th MTU at Fort Ord, California at the time. Fort Ord closed right after that. So I went down. My boss told me, he says, I don't know how long you're going to be gone, but you're a pilot. Remember that.
Okay.
And this was the dickhead, you know, that I was telling you about.
Yep.
I said, okay. So I get down there, and here's how regimented that is. No caffeine, no smoke. You get up at the same time every day. You run the same number of miles. Same thing for breakfast. You eat the same thing. Same pant, the same sock on, the same shoe on. Everything is regimented. And if you want to be a good shooter. And they have what's called, you get that black hat that's hanging right up there. You get that black hat if you break 850 out of 900. Standard hardball 45 ammo with a match gun natural. Mm-hmm. You break 850, they the next day they have a ceremony where they get that coveted black hat is magic. You can't buy that hat anywhere. You can't. 2 weeks into the training, I broke 850 with a hardball gun. And you didn't get a wad gun like a national match coat wad gun. You shot a Smith & Wesson Model 41 for your 22.
Okay.
So you shot 300-500 rounds of that every day. And then you shot 200 or 300 rounds of ball or whatever they had. And I broke 850 2 weeks. I was the first guy out of all the guys that were there from all these other installations. And I wore that hat. And here's at all this good shit that I'm telling you.
Yes, sir.
Here's the stuff I remember. So one day I'm shooting and I'm I feel like I'm a rock, man. I feel like I've got arm supports and, you know, use me while I shoot the target. You know, I'm freaking like Arnold Schwarzenegger. I am drilling freaking holes, dude. And I'm getting ready to break. I'm getting ready to get 900. So that's a 25 yard target and the 10 yard target. And I mean, all the intermediate targets.
Right.
So the civilian that's there comes over and here comes Hummel Pie. Okay. So he goes, blows the whistle. Everybody stops. He says, what you doing there, Chief? I said, yes, you are. Yep. He says, you're awfully confident. I said, yeah, because I'm going to smoke. He goes, all right, everybody gather around. Chief's going to break 900.
Oh.
Uh-oh. So he's standing behind me with his little portly ass self and his little mustache, his little porn mustache. And he goes, go ahead, Chief. Pop those other couple of rounds off and show us how it's done. It was fucking miserable. I missed one. I totally missed the target on the first shot. The other two were like outside the actual scoring rings.
Right.
And I turned around and he goes, I bet you won't do that shit again.
Wow. That's what
everybody's watching me.
And I see that every weekend.
Really?
In the competitive shooting world that I live in, going to United States Practical Shooting Association matches where they're super squads, where it's the best of the best are on one squad or you know, based on how they finished last year, and everybody's watching them. And that pressure changes. The ones that have mastered that pressure are the ones that rise to the top. But it's that pressure. That how long did you stay with the shooting sports after that?
Okay, so it's called a traveling shooting team.
Okay.
So it's not actually, it's a part of the MTU. That's my second hat. The first one was destroyed by my ex.
Okay.
And it was one of the old hats, the trucker hats with the mesh in the back and that corny ass four and a half foot brim. Yes, you know what I'm talking about?
Yes,
the, the one that you see on 70s movies where the guy's getting out of a truck and you can go, God, man, is that guy
smoking the bandit?
That's it.
I'm all over it.
So I actually had to go back to Fort Benning and talk to the command sergeant major of the 6th. That's how controlled they are.
Wow.
Yeah, it was pretty amazing. So you're considered traveling team. So we left Fort Ord. They picked the people that were going to represent the 6th MTU travel team. I was the lead. Major. We were the top two shooters, me and a major that was on the team.
Right.
So we go down through California. I remember stopping in some place in California. I can't think of the name of it, but everything in it was copper.
Right.
And it was called the Madonna, I think.
Okay. Yeah, you were in the Madonna. Yes, you outside San Luis Obispo.
Yeah, it was a restaurant.
They had
these giant cakes, and the bathroom was all copper, and you pissed on the floor.
You were outside San Luis Obispo.
I don't know where that was.
Well, I do, because they just had the Area 2 Championship there. There's a range there, a range that's outside of that area.
It was the best restaurant. You know, because they're paying you per diem, so you ate like a king.
I know exactly what you're talking about.
And that was where I think we started to cut over through Nevada and things like that.
Yeah.
So,
I've taken that trip when I drove there. Yes.
No shit.
So, yes, that hotel is still there.
Is it really? Yes,
that's why I know about it. It's still there. Yes.
Oh, my God.
Yes. Yes, sir,
all I can remember is a copper pissers and good cake.
I know.
I mean, is that
they still have signs talking about the strawberry cake.
Yeah, it was. Yeah.
I know.
Get out of here.
I stayed at a Hampton Inn just right down the street from it because I was told not to stay there, but to eat there because there's a Madonna Inn as well. Yes.
That's wild. And you know what's even freakier? Is that 30-something years later, I freaking remember.
Yes, because it's still there today.
See, that OCD shit kicking in. I'm telling you, I'm looking through that Rolodex, and I'm picking out those little things for you.
That's amazing.
Yeah, so.
That's amazing.
So we're shooting, and we got one match. We've got these matches, these scheduled leg matches, all over the United States until we get to camp. So I'm thinking to myself, my nickname is Eddie. That's what everybody back home calls.
Okay.
James Edward. So my nickname.
Okay.
So I'm thinking, Eddie, you're going to get a President's 100.
Okay.
I mean, that's the shit, bro.
Yeah.
President's 100. There's only 100 of us.
Yeah.
So I'm shooting these matches. I get to Birmingham. Here's one you're going to love. All right. So we're in Birmingham. We're getting ready to shoot the Southern Shakedown in Birmingham.
Okay.
And these guys, this is my first taste of optics. These guys getting you know, seeing a guy with optics on his gun.
Right.
Like, what is that? You know, and you're there with your Smith 41 and your box and your wad gun, and you're getting ready to show these civilians how to shoot. And those guys could shoot. So I'm staying at the Embassy Suites in Birmingham, Alabama.
Yeah.
I'm in room 714, which I know because that was the number of a Quaalude. Okay. Now, wait.
The place is still there.
Stop, man. Stop. I'm telling you. I'm going through this Rolodex.
Please do.
So I was in room 714 because if I'm not mistaken, 714 was what was on a Quaalude.
Okay.
All right. So I'm getting ready to go down to dinner. We're in a regimen.
Yeah.
We're shooting a match next day. I get on the fucking elevator. And guess who's in the elevator? Motherfucking Bo Cephas himself.
Holy
cow. He's doing a concert.
Yeah.
So I'm looking at him. I'm looking at all the people around. I said, oh, I don't mean to be rude, but are you? And he says, yes, I am. He's got his glasses on. Yeah. He looks rough up close.
Yeah.
That starts to look rough. Yeah. And I said, man, he goes, you one of those military guys? And I said, yeah, we're here shooting. You want to go to a concert? I got to be back in bed. And he says, all right, we get down. He gets off at another floor and I'm going to the lobby.
Right.
That fucker farts before he gets off the elevator. I'm not shitting you. So him and his guys and somebody drops a fucking wolf cookie in the elevator before they get off.
Continue.
And I'm thinking, should I be privileged and happy that Bo Cephas just shit in that elevator and I'm breathing his ass germs? You know? I mean, think about it.
Oh, God.
So I'm riding this fart-filled elevator down to the lobby, and I get out, and all I can think about is telling my friends, hey, man, I just saw Hank Williams Jr. in the elevator.
Yeah.
You know?
That's amazing.
Here's a follow-up to that. My wife and I were in Nashville, and we were at Academy Sports.
Yes, sir.
And we walked through. She says, hey, I'm going to go over here and look at something. And I walk over, and I'm getting ready to go to gun section because that's the first place to go. I'm either looking for ammo or shit on sale. And there's Bo Cephas standing there with his wife. And his wife's kind of pretty. I don't know. I think she might have passed now.
I'm not sure.
But
oh, my goodness.
So he's standing there by the clothes, and I go, Hank Williams Jr. goes, yeah, that's what he is. I says, hey, let me tell you something. He goes, I did. He goes, what is it? And he starts doing that. Look, he's raw.
Yes, he is.
Dude, he's raw.
He is real American.
Socially, he's raw.
Yeah, he is just.
He's American, but he don't care. You know, he can throw it out there and shit like that. You and I'd go to jail for it.
Exactly.
That's why I'll tell you what, he's raw enough to where he said some shit that's why he's not singing Monday Night Football right
exactly,
now.
Okay? Exactly.
But he was still nice. He goes, we know each other. I said, yeah. I said, you shit in an elevator in Birmingham, Alabama back in the 80s before I got off at the lobby. He goes, I don't remember it. I said, well, you did. He goes, well, so you military? You know, I'm thinking, you shit in an elevator, motherfucker. I wanted some contrition. I want to say something. You know, give me an autograph.
That's amazing.
You know. So, but anyway, so to make this really good story bad.
Oh, this is amazing. This is amazing.
We're in Birmingham.
Yeah.
And we're going to Fort Benning. And that's where they're going to hone us for shooting against the Marines and the FBI up at Quantico and everybody all the way to Perry. So I'm 2 months out. I'm a month and a half out from really getting my President's Hunter because I'm going to get it.
All right.
And I get a call. The civilian walks in and says, hey, Mr. Patrick, he said, you got a call. So I've been gone for a couple months now, 2 months maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And it's my boss. Patrick, I said, yes, sir. You're a pilot or you're a shooter? Sir, I'm going to, he says, no, you don't fucking understand. I'm telling you right now, you find a plane tomorrow back to Alaska because they needed the pilots.
You're a pilot first.
Yep. And he said, or you stay there and we'll work on the rest of it from this. I said, sir, he says, hangs up. So I turn around and Bithos had already pre-briefed the civilian mine. He says, I'll get your ticket. So he comes back next day, says, we can't get you tickets, but we can get you a MAC flight out of Oklahoma, here to Oklahoma City to blah, blah, blah. I said, okay. I ended up going back to Alaska and never got to shoot the President's 100.
Wow.
All because of one asshole. And when we got up there, the mission load was not so significant that they actually really needed. He had a hair up his ass and I was the recipient of all his pain and all that's wrong in his life. So
wow.
That's where we went. But it didn't stop me from shooting.
Yeah.
I've been shooting. I mean, if you've on Instagram, I mean, that 70-yard target I could hit with a 3.5.
Right.
So,
that's so cool.
But other than that, I mean, it's just, it's funny that you bring up all these things, you know. I mean, I never thought I'd have to think about Bo Cephas farting in a fucking elevator again.
Just, either, it's amazing. Know? I had no idea. We didn't talk about that earlier.
Oh, here's one for you. So you want to hear something funny. I had to, when we were in Alaska, and if Gary's listening to this, he'll remember this too. We had to go down to Fort Chaffee, Arkansas every year for JRTC. So we flew from Alaska on a C-5 into Muskogee, Oklahoma. On a C-5 with all our birds, we set everything up. We went and did the mission over in Louisiana and or Arkansas, and then we came back. And you know, so I got sick. I had a really bad tooth infection, EMJ going on, and I couldn't fly. So I went to a doctor, a local doctor, and he said, hey. Went back and he said, well, look, almost the end of the mission, so we'll send you back. So I think it's Tinker Air Force Base, no call. So they said, look, we can get you a flight on a C-5 that's going to Seattle on Tinker. So I get to Seattle, but I get to the wrong terminal. Mm-hmm. And I got to be at this one terminal at McCord Air Force Base at a certain time. So I'm standing out front, and there are these two very healthy women that are standing there going, you need a ride? And I go, yeah, I do. Because here I am. I'm a strapping, but, you know, crew cut, yep, flight suit wearing pilot, yeah, you know. And I'm going, yeah, I got to go to this at McCord. Otherwise, I'm going to miss my plane. And they go, hop in. So I go over and look, and it's like a fucking Vega. I mean, I didn't even think they had these cars. I think they were all, like, burned because of some FDA recall or some shit.
Exactly.
So these two women get in the front, and uh-huh, they fill up the front. I mean, their shoulders are touching.
Right.
And I'm sitting in the back with my bag, and they're driving and turning, or both turning around on the highway, doing whatever that fucking Vega would go. I mean, it was screaming. It sounded like somebody with no rims skidding down the road. And they're like, what you doing here? You're going to stay overnight? And I'm thinking, oh, my God, they're going to kidnap me. These two women are going to kidnap me. Oh, you're so cute. And one would reach back and touch my leg. And I'm like, God damn, get me out of this fucking little car. So we finally pull up to the gate, and they can't go in because they have a sticker or whatever it was. And right, they let me out, and the MP there gave me a ride, and I made the flight. But, dude, you're bringing up all kinds of bad shit. I want you to delete this fucking podcast.
I didn't bring this up at all. This is all you. I know,
but my Rolodex is still spinning in there, and it's pulling out all the bad shit for some reason.
Well, let's take not a break, but let's go to when you got out.
Yeah.
And you're out. You did 28 years of your life in the military. And if I haven't said it enough, thank you for, you know, what you have done to keep our freedom where it's at and some of the stuff you had to do. So thank you. And, you know, what we talked about at the first part of the podcast where you were actually making something, you know, you had this idea of taking a coin and turning it into a ring.
I wish that was my original. I wish I had invented that.
Yeah, I know, but what made you, you know, you gone to knife shows, you done all this other stuff, and what gave you the idea to say, I want to do this myself? Where does that come from?
Trying to be occupied.
Okay.
Harder it is, the better.
Okay.
Like, you know, I don't know you, but I've got a couple of handmade. Mm-hmm. When I was making knives.
Yeah.
And, I don't know. I think that's the harder it is. I think the more I want to do it.
Right.
I don't want to just do it to say I did it.
Right.
But I want to do it. And then if I need to do it later, I can do it. Like your ring.
Yes.
You know, I mean, like the first time I did a platinum ring or the first time I did a gold ring, and I don't do it for a living. I don't do it to make money.
No,
I mean, I can't tell you the number of people that I've actually.
You told me you make them all the time. You're wearing them and somebody likes it and you give them away.
Yeah, I do. I made golf club canes for older people because they have no hand strength.
Mm-hmm.
So I would go to the union, the thrift shops, and buy these graphite golf clubs.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd cut them off, and I'd put those rubber stoppers on it, and then I'd put those, you know, those little tiny pool balls?
Yes.
I'd drill out the pool balls and put a shank in it, and I'd glue it. And because old people can pick those up, and it's the perfect size. Mm-hmm. I used to carry 3-4 of those around in my car, and I'd see somebody struggling to walk on their own without a cane. I'd go up to them and I'd measure them. I'd say,
wow.
But you know, it all comes back to, if it was left up to me as an animal, I don't think I would be like this if it wasn't for outside influences.
Mm-hmm.
Like my wife. I can't imagine my life what it is right now.
Right.
I don't have a gazillion dollars,
mm-hmm.
but that's not making me happy. But she's my soulmate. And she thinks like I do, and I think like she does. We're just both as kind to a fault. I mean as fuck, though.
That's why I was intrigued by you to begin with. I know you had a story.
Down inside, there's a Viking in me just scratching.
Right.
So, but yeah, I just, all the shit that really doesn't mean anything. I've got, you know, like my wife.
Right.
I mean, they do, but they're going to end up somebody else.
Right.
There's no U-Haul going to follow.
No.
But what I do have, I have the memories of heroes and have made this. And like I said, I'm not a religious guy.
Right.
At all. But what I do believe is your soul, how long your memory.
Wow.
Because if you think about it, there are great things your grandparents did and you remember them and they're still alive mm-hmm. in you.
That's right.
They are. I mean, I remember as a young private not having any money and going to visit, see my grandmother because she pulls a $50 bill out of her, gives it to me. I took it because I plan on paying her back and she died before it haunted me. That 788 that I went hunting with, that I killed my first deer with.
Yes, sir.
I needed money as a young private. So I pawned it. I would get it out at the end of the month. I'd pawn it again. Get it out. That I didn't have money to get it out, and I would go to pay. And I said, look, tell me who it is. I'll buy it. You know, 'cause I was going to sell other shit to get it back. I never found it again. And as much as my dad and I didn't see eye to eye before he died mm-hmm. in 1990, he was back to being proud of something.
Right.
Because I was a W-4 at the time. He didn't know I get promoted to W-5.
Right.
And, you know, once you make W-5, I guess, you know, you get unicorn status. So it's, but only about 5 to 7%
wow.
people get promoted. There's at any time, I think the number is 120 to 130.
Mm-hmm.
W-5s in there.
Wow.
And
amazing.
People give it more credence than I do. I was totally blown away. And I have to, I have to give my wife a lot.
Right.
She is so supportive. And you know what? You understand this. When somebody likes your spouse, it makes everything.
Yes.
People love Becky. They just love her.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely love her. So I ride that train and she rides my train. I don't know. It's one of those things that you wish you could pass on to kids.
Right.
They have to learn.
Yep. They do.
Yeah.
Well, Jim, today being here, hanging out, watching some of the crafts you do behind the scenes and touching other people's lives, you've touched mine, and
not physically.
No, not at all. But I was crying earlier, but it was only because of the joy. Some of the
made me a ring to him.
Some of the great stories that just had me going and going and going, and your little touch of the shooting sports that brings us, you know, all this stuff, you know, going around the world constantly. We don't know, you know, everybody's background. We don't know, but all the shooting sports bring us together in some way or another.
You're right.
And
we're so privileged.
And that's what happened today.
You can't do this shit in another country.
No.
Not hardly. It's
the have and have nots in other countries, because there's a lot of shooting that goes on in other countries as far as competitive shooting sports and IPSC. But that's exactly right. That's it. It's the haves.
Like I remember before I left Germany, the PX over there. They used to sell at the rod and gun clubs and all these things that were concentrated on shooting sports.
Not that way anymore.
No, not at all. Wow. Matter of fact, you can't even take a gun over there anymore.
All right. Yep.
Wow.
Any last messages? We can cut this one off, I think, for today.
Yeah, I think that for future podcasts, when you're doing this, you should wear clothes.
Okay, fair enough. That's why I didn't
do that.
That's why there's not a video episode of this.
Yeah, I know. That's why I've been staring at the walls the whole time. And like when I put my hand up like I'm going to sneeze, it's just to hide your body.
I love you, man.
I'm sorry, man.
But it's amazing.
I mean, you know, once you pass 50, you should.
Yeah, I know, but you know, you did invite me in the office, so it is what it is.
Yeah, but I didn't close the door.
No, you didn't. It's still open.
Well, I can tell you, I went into this with a little bit of trepidation because I don't like throwing my shit out.
No, but, Jim,
you made it easy.
Well, thank you.
You did. You made it easy.
You're very welcome, and just for people to have a little bit of history of what, you know, it looked like before, they don't know. And to hear a little bit about that and how it used to be is, I think this can help some people. That's just how I feel.
You know, and pass it on. Teach that young kid to shoot.
That's it.
Pull that phone out from their face.
Yep.
Take them out and get them a little 22.
Exactly. I
mean, even if they go into it kicking and screaming, they're going to turn around one day and tell them, not in front of you because you're your parent.
Yep.
You know? They're going to go, hey, you know what? I went out and shot 22 this week. So they're going to get street cred off of it. But, just, we've lost our way somehow. See all these guns and things that are magnificent, magnificent tools.
Yep, tools. That's the key.
Magnificent tools.
They're definitely tools. Yeah. Well, Jim, thank you so much again for
sitting down.
I had a blast. Thank you again. I will have this ring on so people want to see me at matches. They'll see some of the stuff you did, and I'll put your information out there. Get ready to make thousands of them.
I'm just kidding.
Please don't. I'm just kidding.
But the next time you come, bring a robe.
I will. Thank you so much. Well, thank you so much for listening to this episode of Hunter's HD Gold Behind the Lens. And until next time, we'll see you at the range soon. Thank you so much, Jim.
4 complete written transcript of the Dr. Bill Show, go online to www.icarusmusic.com.
And welcome back to the Dr. Bill Show. Let's go to a caller who seems to be having issues communicating with his girlfriend. Caller?
Yeah, I'd had this problem with my girlfriend. She kind of broke up with me. I've been doing everything right. Everything's been going great. We've been going out for, I don't know, I'd say a good 5-6 months. Everything's good. I mean...
But, son, you've got to use communication.
I've done that. I mean, what else can I do? I mean, seriously, I mean, like, I...
Son. Some girls are just bitches.